Okay, so today I am in Star Sports' Mayfair VIP lounge in the betting shop there with Steve Cooling.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks very much for coming in today. So you're an odds compiler, but currently head of trading and strategy implementation at TTP Trade the Prices. So what is Trade the Prices and what is it that you do?
You've obviously done your homework checking up on me. When I left Stan James, or made redundant from Stan James, 2009, I did actually, it's a proper company, you can check it, Companies House. Trade the Prices was a company set up to initially provide odds the day before for Hove Greyhounds, some football prices. There was a horse race section and a non-league football section. And it was to, it was my way of trying to get some form of income. Basically because most of my working life had been in the betting industry. I'm no good painting and decorating, car mechanic, electrician. That was it. It didn't work out. At the highest point, I think I have four people paying £99 a month for some Hove prices. And I have to say it didn't work. I put that on there on Twitter because, you know, whilst it's not officially a trading company, I've given myself that title.
Yeah, so, but you still, we'll come onto it in a bit, but you still put odds that you've compiled up for free for people to see.
I do, yeah, I do. Basically Swindon. I've been...
Swindon dogs, that is.
Swindon greyhounds, yeah. I've been a massive greyhound fan for years, really. It's just about the nearest track, Swindon or Oxford. I've always been on and off Swindon regular. Had dogs there and started going there just prior to lockdown with little grandson who he took an interest watching the greyhounds on television. He was fascinated by the traps, the hair, the colours of the graphics, and took him to a trial session on a Tuesday morning. I thought there's no betting there, there's not encouraging him to have a bet or anything. And he just loved it. And he's been racing 20 odd times at Swindon. He's been to Toaster, been to Oxford. He knows all the staff there. He'll quite happily, go and stay with the track staff. That got me back into Swindon after about a gap of 12, 15 years. And I started pricing up the card the day before for my benefit, for when I went to Swindon, and I would use it for betting, trading. I wanted to know the prices before I'd actually got there. I couldn't operate having seen prices. I wanted my own opinion before ever I'd got racing.
Okay, now you're an odds compiler. You've been an odds compiler since the early 80s. now, you've told me a lot about yourself. You've priced up horses, basketball, ice hockey, German ice hockey, basketball, greyhounds, corners in football matches, golf and football in running. Anything I missed?
Probably not. I started 1980, I was at Ladbrokes for 5.5 years. So we're 80 to 85, that was in a shop. Local town, first of all, then on relief, and then switched to Stan James in October 85. And then gradually, as teletext and debit card betting and supplying other bookmakers with prices on the screens, that was down to my main role, and you sort of had to learn things pretty quickly. I was responsible for all the information that went on the screens out to independent bookmakers. Early prices on the horses, probably only 5 or 6 a day back in those days. The speciality sports, it was pretty comprehensive. And then as a Stan James company, we were on teletext. We looked to expand in all different ways. It was, let's just try it. I would say to Steve Fisher, I think we should bet on the British basketball. I know a guy there that does the commentaries for the matches. He's obviously basketball mad. I'm pretty happy with the way I can form handicap prices, similar to rugby league, which I used to do. I'd do my handicaps down. I'd speak to a guy called Daniel at the British Basketball. If I was London Towers against Leicester, if I was Leicester plus 6 points and he was seven, he said, I think, yes, he would give me his figures. I would go six. If he was 10, I'd probably go eight. And we were up and running. We were probably, as a company, the first firm that would bet on those matches. There'd be a live match on Sky, which was fantastic interest. Anything live on Sky or live on TV was of massive interest.
I mean, how did you, all right, you explained how you did that, but yeah. I mean, how did you get a handle on so many sports to the extent that you could take the punters on and beat them? Because there must have been punters out there that knew more than you.
Well, when you think, going back, so we're going back to early 90s, early 90s, and you've got no internet, you've got teletext. Teletext was kind of the first version of any kind of technology where people could get information. There was no, or very few forums, there was very few Telegram groups advising you to do this, that and the other. You just had to the best of your knowledge, you look on past results, past form, league tables, you would come up with a set of prices. I'd always try and get a three-runner event rather than a two-runner event. Obviously, more, in theory, profit for the bookmaker. So we'd have an ice hockey match. Tended to handicap it so the underdogs would get a goal head start, sometimes two. And you'd just sort of, through practice, really, and repetition.
Where did you learn to compile odds?
Well, self-taught, really. It's like if you imagine you had to come up with some football prices. The only information you got were previous odds. So say you've got Man City against, I don't know, Man City against Sheffield United, and you think Man City would be, I don't know, 16s on, 14s on, or something like that, and then Man City and Bournemouth, 10s on, 9s on. Something like that, in that ballpark, you've got that as part of your reference. If they played a team that were in the middle of that price range, that would be your starting point. And very quickly you build up, but you'd say, oh, this team with this price against this team. There was nothing to tell you were wrong. You didn't go and have to put them on a thing called odds checker, because there was no such thing.
Punters would tell you if you were wrong,
wouldn't they? Oh, they would do, yeah, but how many punters would... You know, it's easy to do it on odds checker. Everybody's 5-2 and you're 4-1. Are you wrong? Are you wrong, or are all the others wrong? Difficult to say one way or another.
Okay, now I've had people like you in these interviews before. So far, none of them have been able to tell me how they do it.
Okay.
So can you see if you can tell me how you do it? Tell me how you price up a greyhound race. Where would you start?
Okay. I get the runners, the advanced runners. With the dogs, you get the cards are made up by the racing office. So where are we tomorrow? We're Saturday tomorrow. Well, those runners came out yesterday. I've had a quick look through it. I probably won't price up that card. The best example is probably a Thursday meeting at Swindon. I'd get the runners on a Monday afternoon. I'd write them all out. And I'd start looking. I'd look at the grade of the race. I'd look at the dogs. When did they last run? How many ran on the same day? So we're looking back. How many ran on, say, the 2nd of February? We look down on, we've got the full form, race card form. You will find certain dogs ran in the same race. Ah, there's three of them there. Ran in the same race, same grade. This was 7-4 favourite. Led to the running, got caught by this dog. I'd try and find a favourite, and I'd put it in, and I'd look through. This is quite a tightly graded race. I might be 11-4 the field. I'd put it down. If you've seen the sheets I write, you'll see all these pencil. It's basically, I'm putting my thoughts down. So you'd see 11-4. It might end up 7-2. So I've got a price by every dog, based on the trap draw, previous form in the grade. If it's a new dog or relatively new dog. all sorts of things get put into the melting pot. And I'd go through each race. Now I'd stop, as long as I got a percentage, and this is where a lot of people would, they'd lose interest, they get baffled by maths and science. As long as I've ended up with an over round, so between 125 and 133, I would leave it. I'd move on to the next race, I'd go all through the card. Probably take me an hour and a quarter, hour and a half to do 12 races. I would then leave it for some time, i.e. come back and look at it on a Tuesday. With those prices I've ended up, I put those prices as if that were the prices for the race, and I'd go through it again. And I would look, and I'd go through it again. I'd get the final confirmed runners from the track. There may be some alterations. A couple of dogs might get taken out and you might have to reprice it. But basically, from that point, I'd end up at 127, 128, and that would be it. Am I happy with it? Yes. Put the final prices down, and that would be it. There's an easy way. I've been asked quite a few times how would you do it? If you imagine you've got a dice, right? So you've got one to six, you've got six runners. Okay? Now if a bookmaker offered 5-1 each dog, true odds of each number coming up, it's not the ookie dice or anything. As a punter, if you had a series of bets, you might or might not win a few quid. As a bookmaker, you couldn't offer 5-1 each because you've got your overheads. We're sat in this lovely office and the staff are going to want paying. You couldn't offer 5-1 each. If you offered 4-1 each, then all of a sudden you've got a margin. So the easy way for somebody who wants to price up, have a go at pricing up a greyhound race, take your dice, put the theory of the dice, put every dog in at 4-1 on the race card, and then look at it yourself and you'll say, hang on, this dog shouldn't be 4-1, this should be a lot shorter. Now, 6-4s are 24, so 4-1 down the card. You've got to end up with 24. So if you change 1 to 3-1, that's 3. Change 1 to 2-1, it's 2. You've got to push things out, you've got to push your number out a bit bigger. Work through as best you can. If you understand anything about greyhound form, people will to a certain degree, but you must end up at 24. Then leave it, go and look at another race and go and do another one. So do 3 races and then go back, which is the same as I do, go back and then have a recheck. And then in the morning, when you get the final runners, in the morning when you get the racing post, bloody hell, this thing I've got 2-1, 6-1. You'll have a look. And that's the only way you can do it. Once you've seen a set of prices, whether it be for a horse race, a football match, a dog race, it's very hard. If you've seen a set of prices, 6-1 or whatever, you can't then put it in at 12, or you can't put it in at 3, because you've seen that price and it's in your mind. So the only way you can do it is literally from the bare form. As Shane, the one of the last ones I watched, he prices his horses up. And you've got to be comfortable that you're pretty much right. You're going to make mistakes, yes. But in the long run, you're more right than wrong. And that's the only way I can do it.
And just quickly, so you've priced them up. If in the morning you say you've made something 6-1, the racing post make it 12-1, are you right and they're wrong? Is that what you think?
It's very difficult to say. Very difficult.
But would you be confident to think they've made a rick there? Would you think?
No, I wouldn't say that. The difference between 6-1 and 12-1, I wouldn't be looking to. If I was looking to have a bet, I wouldn't be looking to back something that I'd made 6-1, and it's 12-1 in the post. What I would be looking to possibly get involved with is something I've made 7-4, 2-1. That's 7-2, 4-1 in the racing post, which is what the guide that the main bookmakers use. I'd be looking to possibly back that 6 or 7-1, and we see.
Okay, Steve, so part one we talked about pricing up greyhounds. Now you actually trained them, but you trained them for racing around flapping tracks, and you gave me some names: Warwick, Hickley, Bedwellty, The Valley, Chesterfield and Highgate. Names that normally spring to... tell us about that.
Well, it's Hinckley, which is in between Coventry and Leicester. 83 miles from my house to Hinckley. I used to go every Wednesday if I could. Warwick, 64 miles. So, you know, a fair bit of travelling. I had, when I moved up to where I am now, I had some kennels built, bottom of the garden. A mate of mine did all that for me. And I had sort of three or four dogs at any one time for a period of about 5 or 6 years. And I absolutely loved it. It was a sort of thing, a flapping track is basically was an unlicensed track. It wasn't part of the NGRC then, National Greyhound Racing Club. It was basically anybody could take a greyhound there. You'd have one qualifying trial. You'd have to trial with another dog. And as long as you did grading time, you could run it whenever you wanted. The beauty of it was you could pick and choose. If you've got dogs graded on at different tracks, you could pick and choose. I'm going to Hinckley Wednesday night. We might have a ride down to Bedwellty, which is down in Wales, or Ystrid Monarch, which is the valley. They're about 6 miles apart. The valley has since reopened as a licensed track, the GB track. You can see pictures of that in the betting shops and obviously now online you can watch the races. But that was an independent track, a flapping track. And I was a proper greyhound trainer. And I got my dog or my dogs and I would go on to Hinckley on a Wednesday night. You'd phone up and enter them on a Monday morning. You'd turn up, you wouldn't know what race you were in. It was all very cloak and dagger stuff. The tracks didn't like you knowing in advance who was in with who, because everybody was thinking everybody's up to no good. And if I would turn up sometimes with one dog, because I only had one dog, I'd go all the way to Hinckley on my own. I wouldn't look to bet. I'd have a tenner on if it was 4-1 or more. I'd have to get somebody to do that because I'm putting the dog in the traps, getting the dog at the pickup. But absolutely loved it.
Was that why you were doing it? Because you loved it?
I loved it.
Like there's much money in it.
There isn't. No, you have to pay to get in. So you pay £3.50 to get in, or £3 at most tracks. You'd have to pay to enter your dog. So you're in the paddock. They come around, check your earmarks, check the dog's earmarks. You'd pay £3 entry fee for the race. Most places it was £25 for a win, and that was it.
So what sort of people run these tracks?
At Hinckley was Tommy Grant and his stepson. They had a bungalow adjacent to the property, and the track had been there for years. Warwick, it was leased out to various people down behind an old boiler factory through some allotments, but it was a beautiful track. And they used to get a lot of people there, all people I remember from surrounding villages from where I am. There'd be 7 or 8 people they'd have dogs, they'd go to Warwick.
So was it illegal or just not licensed?
No, it wasn't. No, it was just not licensed. It wasn't recognised as part of the National Greyhound. It was nothing illegal. It's not like air coursing or anything like that. You'd have the programme and the results would be printed in various local, the local newspaper for that area. It was just an opportunity for somebody to train greyhounds.
So why did you go down that route and not under rules?
I wouldn't like the thought of a track telling me that you've got 3 runners tomorrow night. Or I would rather pick and choose where I want to go and when I want to go. Like, I wouldn't set off if it was going to be really bad weather, in advance, put 3 dogs in to go somewhere when I know it's going to be -2, and I wouldn't do it. So I just went down. The opportunity was there. You didn't need any form of kennel visits or anything like that. If you had a dog, you could go racing.
So how was the... I mean, you said you have a tenner on, but I mean, was there spirited betting, and who was taking the bets, and what sort of size money was going
on?
And was it bent?
Let's do one question at a time. There was a hell of a crowd there.
I'm getting carried away.
I know. Yeah. there was a hell of a crowd there. I mean, Hinckley was probably the strongest market. There was five bookmakers there. A couple of them were racecourse bookmakers. I saw them at Southall. Ah, so-and-so from Hinckley. I don't go horse racing, or didn't go horse racing very often. There was some money around at these tracks, Hinckley. Later on, at times I would have a few more quid on, sometimes quite a few quid, if you thought you were in the right grade, and as you become more experienced as a trainer, or so-called trainer. Was it bent? You'll hear so many stories. There was plenty of skullduggery. There was. My sort of angle to try to, if I fancied one of mine, I knew what sort of grade it was in. I knew the opposition. I used to get the video of every race at the meeting. I managed to get hold of the runners prior to race day. And you would get to know. If you've entered three dogs in 500 yard races, and they've got your best dog in the worst race, then you'd have to have a look at it. But it was fantastic. It was real what we call doggy people. Used to have a great laugh, lots of banter. It was amazing. It really was. And then just gradually died out.
Well, that's my next question. I mean, you've trained 80 winners.
I tried to have a count. It's just over 80 winners. Yeah. It doesn't sound meant. Well, it
does. It sounds quite a few.
It's probably over four or five years.
Yeah.
But the thing with it, because the attention that the dog needs, you couldn't, it was to the exclusion of a lot of other things. You couldn't really do too much else. You're with them in the morning, you know, breakfast, and then feeding in the evening, cleaning them out, checking their nails, all sorts of things. You had to put a lot of work in with the dogs.
And did you train them and own them all yourself?
Yeah, they're my dogs, yeah.
So you didn't used to train for anybody else?
A long-standing friend of mine sadly passed away. He had shared, we had the dogs between us, but basically I would go to Perry Bar Sales, I'd buy dogs, I'd pay 40 or 50 guineas, and they've all turned out winners. I wouldn't pay a lot of money for a dog, but you've got a dog, it's a commitment. You've got that dog, then you're responsible for that dog. When the tracks were closing, we made sure we found homes locally for when they're retiring. One of them I've kept indoors, she was always indoors. She was with me till passed away just before I aged 11. But she was always indoors. I'd be here watching the telly, she'd be on the sofa.
So how many would you have had at any one given time?
Never more than four. You'd need two cars to take four dogs. My mate used to take four dogs in the back of a car. It's too much. So we'd take two cars out, take them for a nice long walk a couple of times a week. It really did the best for the dogs.
And you've already talked about pricing up your grand. So is that for your own personal punting, or do you do it for anybody?
Well, I've started turning up at Swindon, and there's a couple of trainers and owners and people that I've got to know. Oh, let's have a look. What price do you make this? What price do you make that? And I said, well, I'll send it to you if you want. Occasionally, I'll send a message to one of the trainers or a couple of the trainers, so-and-so looks well in Thursday. You'll either get a reply, yeah, I think it'll win, or I don't know, it's been, you might get some reply. The best reply is for the chances of it winning, if there was no reply at all. I thought, I don't want to say anything about this.
You have to rejig your prices then?
Not really, no, once I've done them, no. But, so that was going out to quite a few people on a WhatsApp basis.
Free?
No, I've never charged anybody. Originally back in with the Hove in 2009, a lot of people said you should charge for this. I don't feel that you're under pressure then to have to do it. If I choose not to do it, I choose not to do it. But it was going out to a lot of people. A couple of trainers were saying, why don't tip any of my dogs up? There's a telegraph, set a telegram group up, and all I'll do is highlight price differences. There'd be a dog open, say it's 9-4 with 365. half an hour later, up comes Paddy Power and the Skybet lot, and they're 5-1. I make it a 9-4, 2-1 shot, and a 2-1 shot that I think will run well. I would advise people, such and such, trap one in the thing, looks overpriced at 5-1. It's got every chance of leading all the way. I'm not saying go out and try and get as much as you can on it. I'm just reporting the fact that I think it's overpriced.
Hence, trade the prices. So
it's, well, yeah, it's pined off. Yeah,
to
yeah,
nothing
yeah,
if you
yeah,
could.
Yeah, there's, I mean, there's a little story without mentioning too many names. They've got a nice few quid on a 9-2 shot that's shortened up. It's gone off 11-10. And obviously, they've got rid of it, which you can do in this day and age, and stood to sort of win 800 quid for nothing, a free bet for 800 quid. Got beat at short head.
Now, people like the sound of this, so there could be hundreds of people watching this now that are thinking, Steve does it for free. So can they get in contact with you or not?
Well, I set up a Telegram group. It all started from the horses when I retired as such, and I started, I would say I was a professional punter for 4 months until the inevitable happened. I got shut, couldn't get a bet on. Now, whether it was me being naive or being out of touch, being out of the game for 10 years or so, I couldn't believe it. Bookmakers wouldn't take bets. So the horses that I was, what I was doing in this horse racing in a professional way, I was still putting some horses up on Twitter that would be the sort of horses I would back. And then it went to a Telegram group. And then I set a Telegram group up for the dogs and a bit of non-league football. And I thought, well, hey ho, it's you know, it's easy to set up. I wasn't worried about giving information away. But on the Greyhound side of things, I've had a couple of trainers get in touch with me. Why are you tipping up my dogs? I've got my owners going mental. They're paying this amount for these dogs and they can't, because all your lot are taking all the prices. And I'm thinking, well, hang on, it's not totally me, surely.
Well, it's a public sport, isn't it? So,
well, it is. I'd always send a nice reply. I wouldn't just say, no, sling your up. I'd always send a nice reply. I fully understand it. I'm just highlighting price differences, really.
So are you betting at the moment?
No, not to a very small degree. A couple of years ago, at Swindon, in the morning meetings, yes, I was. I was getting stuck in and I was laying them for a few quid, backing them for a few quid. One of the guys on Twitter said to me, I really like your odds sheet. I back every dog of yours that's 7-2 or less, providing I can get 10-1 or more. And I thought, well, that's not a bad way of doing it. And he sent me some results and I started checking the results. Now, it was amazing. Well, when you think, if you say the 7-2 is somewhere near correct, if you can get 10, 12, 14 to 1, you can have a few free goes at that. And so, it is amazing the number of winners it was chucking up. And I was oblivious to this.
So finally, for this bit, can people contact you if they want to get all your prices, or is it that
just via Twitter? Yeah, no, just via Twitter. Honestly, via Twitter, I'm more than happy. I'm not looking to charge anybody. Never have done. I'm in a financial position where I don't need to use it as a form of income, and I wouldn't. You know, if somebody can use the prices and make themselves a couple of quid, then great. It really is great. It is a job to get obviously any money on of any big stakes with dogs at early prices, but yeah, more come through on Twitter and I'll always reply and I'll tell them where they can find it.
All right, Steve, so let's go back to the beginning. It all started for you in 1980 with Ladbrokes. Tell us about how you got into the game.
There was an advert. I left school, did 3.5 years in a supermarket, and then saw an advert. Ladbrokes wanted training manager in Wantage, where I lived. Wow, that was like, well, we'll be applying for that. Anyway, got the job, started my training, ended up running the shop from the sort of July onwards of 1980. Stayed there for a couple of years, went out on relief to different shops, ran the shop at Headington for a while, which was a very, very busy shop. Ended up back in Abingdon in sort of about 84. And then 1985, Steve Fisher was buying out the independent, the little independent bookmaker that was in Abingdon. There was two Ladbrokes shops and an independent. One of the people that worked for the independent used to work for Ladbrokes, and she's come round and said, come and work for Steve Fisher. I knew a guy called Ray who was like Steve Fisher's right-hand man. He ran the shop in Wantage, and we just went round for a little chat, basically. And I remember saying to him, I think it'd be very interesting. There's going to be a kind of a price war, or a, I don't think Ladbrokes would like it, because he, I think Steve was always ahead of the game. Some of the things.
This is Stan James.
This is Steve Fisher. Yep. From, he's there. And I've said to him, I think I'd rather come and, going to be a bit of a war going, I'd come and, rather come and fight for you than stay with Ladbrokes. Yep. So I've jumped ship, basically.
And so you introduced Bog, Best Odds Guarantee, which ruined racing, ruined betting.
Well, hang on. Whoa. I had heard that, I believe it was Corals did it for the whole of a Cheltenham meeting, festival meeting. Got themselves in a right pickle. The thing with Best Odds Guaranteed, if you've got multiple bets and as a bookmaker, you don't really know your true liabilities, because the last one is a 6-1 shot, but in all reality, it could start at 10. There was no, you didn't know your liabilities. Now, I'm in the shop in Abingdon, and we used to have, if you remember the old board markers and the board, there was this marketing kit, and you'd have a little thing, a snooker, you'd have football, and you'd do a board display. Ladbrokes were always keen on, you'd do a board display with an example bet. And there was a thing, and it said race of the day. And I thought, oh, I could do something with that. And I just thought, this would go down well. We'll do one race every day where we would have guaranteed odds. So you came in, we would say to them, we'll put the price on this for you. If the SP is bigger, we'll pay you SP. And they'd look at you as if, oh, bloody hell, you're going crazy. And I think it was a race at Taunton, and it was a 9-4 shot in the morning. It won at 130. And it was on a few multiple bets, and it was a few singles. So when it came in, it paid, you give me too much here, Steve. No. We're going to pay you SP. I took 9-4. No, it won at 130. 43-33. Christ, whatever. People would come in, well, what's the race of the day? What's the race of the day? Word would get around, and word got around in the town. You'd have people coming in. Now, I knew a lot of customers, but they would go to Ladbrokes because it was nearer for them for parking, or all of a sudden, they'd come in and they wouldn't know what race it was. I would decide one race. We'd try and get it earlier on in the afternoon if we could, so that it was all done and dusted and there wouldn't be too much money running on. But we had this one race, which we called Race of the Day, all down to this little mark green and yellow marketing board display. And that took off then. And when we got on to selling as a company called IBS, which was Stan James, selling the screen service to independent bookmakers, it was a massive selling point.
Okay, tell us a bit about Steve Fisher, the founder of Stan James.
Yeah, Steve, well, he started one shop up on the Downs at Compton. Would have been, I suppose, mid-70s. Like, he was from Nottingham, went agricultural college. I'd only seen him a few times in my Ladbrokes days. I went to work for him in October 85. I did a couple of years over at Marlborough. He took two guys on from Ladbrokes. Well, one guy went and ran the Abingdon shop. Would I go to Marlborough? I didn't know where it was. 25 miles, you know, bung me a few quid petrol money, and it was good. But I could tell that he was ahead of the game. He would say to me, football coupons, you shouldn't be waiting for them to turn up. You should have a printer, a computer in your shop, and print it out like they do now. Well, that was, I mean, we're talking 30 years ago. He was always ahead of the game. I got on well with him. I'd say to him, look, I think we should try this. He would just say, try it, do it. I kind of had a free roll which was different to being in an Ladbrokes shop environment. You just felt you're always, there's always people watching you. Have you done this? You will do this. And it was a kind of a, I could express myself more.
And when you joined him, he had five shops.
Five shops.
How many did he have when you left him?
Well, he bought a load of other shops all over the place and a massive telephone business. Shop-wise, 60-odd probably. But obviously the internet's come along. The whole business actually grew and grew and grew. We moved from above a shop in Didcot, Wantage Road in Didcot, where it was six phone lines. You couldn't imagine. Then we moved to a premises in Milton Park, which seemed massive at the time, but we outgrew that. Then we had a purpose-built office down on Grove Technology Park, sort of 5 minutes from me. And at its height, I think we had about 105 people there, 105, 110 people there.
Okay, so in 1990, you were responsible for putting everything on the screens. All
that's
of a sudden,
it.
The screens are all
yeah,
up there.
Yeah, yeah, we've got
12 shops at this point. And
that's
you were
correct.
Putting everything on there.
Yeah, yeah.
So that must have been quite a labour-intensive.
It was.
Long
we
job.
Had, you had 15 pages of information that need to be on display. You'd probably have half a dozen early prices. Well, then you could phone a thing called the Jackson and Lowe Morning Price Indicator. You'd phone, there's no 898 number, everybody would phone it. They bookmakers would phone it. That was the tissue of the day, basically. Everybody would phone it. If they say that they didn't use it, then they were telling poor kids. I would get those. I would add a little bit to some of the prices. I'd look in the Sporting Life. If it was seven and if it was nine in the Life, I'd go a little bit bigger. I'd try and be as competitive as I could. But those were the early prices on the horses. We had to put the football prices up, but we used them from the coupon. And then there was any other stuff that was suggested by SIS for that day. It was based around what Hills were going to be betting on. So you'd have some snooker matches, you'd have some tennis matches, and I had to sort of find a way, beg, steal or borrow, and come up with some prices to put on these screens. Now we had 12 as shops as Stan James. We had other independent bookmakers were on board from more or less day one. Paul Golder, Pickwick Racing, Jamie Bruce, Don Bruce, Ryslip, Taylor's Racing in Reading, Regency Racing in the Midlands came in. There was all, it grew and grew. And eventually there was, at its height, there was well over 1,000 shops, independent shops, taking these prices.
And you were responsible for all the odds as well?
Yeah, it was down to me. I had to put the display up. That was down to me. There were also then, the Corals had a tri-cast. I was checking some results or putting papers up in the shop or doing something, looking at the dog results, and it said Corals tri-cast. I thought, what was that? So it wasn't very easy to work out. They just basically took the SPs of the three dogs. Four, if it was three, four to one shot, four times four, 16, times four, 64, 64 quid. Very, checked it for a few other races. So I've spoke to Steve Fisher. I think we should be offering tri-cast. Look, this is what Corals are doing. Oh God, you know, do you think people would do tri-cast? Yeah, of course they would. Dog racing then, in betting shops, are far more popular than it is now.
The two meetings on a Saturday morning, I remember.
Oh,
them, yeah.
Unbelievable scenes. I remember being in, I actually spent my 16th birthday in a betting shop.
Don't try this now, kids.
No, don't. No, you mustn't, please. Yeah, thanks for that, Simon. But 16th birthday, it was Hackney Dogs, and there was a dog called West Ham. And I had £2 on this dog, it won at 4-1. Now that was a fortune as a 16-year-old, when you could buy a pair of baggy jeans and some screw-in stud football boots for sort of £3 a go. That was a fortune. But yeah, the Greyhound side of things was still popular in the shops. So we started introducing the tri-cast, so we'd use the Corals formula and add 3.5% on. So Corals would pay £64, we'd be 64 plus the 3.5%. But I had to send that over, to calculate it and send it over after each race to update on the screen. the actual method was flawed, because if you had a 12-1 shot, finish third, the dog isn't 12-1. It's 12-1 to win the race. It's not 12-1 to come third. So it took a bit of recalculation.
Did you have some clever punters?
Yeah,
tuck
they were.
You up?
Well, we just about got away with it. There was a group of shops. Lewis Cowan had some shops based in and around Reading, and he had one just opposite Reading Station, across the road. Now, the guy that ran that lived half a mile from me, a guy called John Kearsley. Now, he moved on to Arthur Prince and then Corals. The last I heard of him, he was doing a little bit part-time on the race course, but I've not seen or spoken to him for years. He would get these two guys, they'd turn up, they'd come down on the train from London, and they would do tri-casts, field, trap, 4, 20-1 shot. Now, you wouldn't normally have 20-1 shots in graded races, but every now and again you'd have some opens. There'd be a competition on at Hackney. You'd have some open races and you'd have some big price dogs that theoretically couldn't win the race, but they weren't 12-1, 20-1 to come third. So it took a little bit of thinking about. Now, where John lived and I lived, in between us was a guy called Malcolm Boyle, which you may have heard of, Placebot book, all sorts of things. He was a former...
One of my first interviewees.
Well, there we go. Well, he lived in between John and myself. We would meet up on a couple of times in on the morning, and I'd drive him down. We'd go down the pub. Malcolm and John would have a couple of pints. I wasn't too bothered. I was driving. And we'd try and put the world to rights. And one of the things came up, John was... about this tri-cast. Oh no, he said it wouldn't be 12-1 to come third, this and that. Now, both of us independently have designed a chart that where 12-1 would be sort of 9-2 to come third, 20-1 would be 7 or 8, and we scaled it down, and then very soon we had to revise the way we did it. So we used the Bags forecast, which was coming to computer straight forecast, and then multiplied it by this kind of new factor. But we were fortunate in as much as we didn't get caught, and none of the shops got caught with a big payout. That would have been my fault.
So you were onto hiding to nothing on the odd occasion.
Oh yeah, definitely. My neck was on the line quite a few times. Luckily we're still intact, yeah.
All right, Steve. Now, I think anyone watching this can see that you were quite innovative. And bearing in mind, this is still the days before the internet and what's become normal now. In 1995, you were betting in running on football and golf. That was something very new. Actually putting the prices in live. How did you know what prices to put in, and what sort of references were you using to come up with them? Was it trial and error, or...?
We started, I believe we were the first firm to bet a football match in running. Typically, when you're taking bets to on the build-up to a live game, just prior to kick-off, all the phones ring in and people are trying to get on. The minute the game kicked off, the phone, people would stop. And all the betting would stop. And it was like, well, hang on, we could keep going. We can do this. We've got a computerised system now in the call centre. If I put prices in, it would change in everybody else's computer. If it looked like a goal was going in or a goal was going in, I would suspend it. So we started, we had Sky Sports Teletext initially. We used to advertise through Sky Sports Teletext. We'd have a little in-running box and it would have the odds. You've got your prices for the match that they were at kickoff time. I would sit there, be watching the match, and I'd have written down the prices I would be if it was 0-0 at half time. Obviously, the draw would shorten up, both sides would be bigger. You'd watch the match. If it was clear that one team were performing, let's say, better than you'd expect them to, you might. Just err on the side of caution. You were governed by your field book. So I've got a computerised field book in front of me. When the bets came in, it was there. It would show that this would lose this, this would win X. I'd also have prices written down in the event of either side scoring.
Were these, sorry to interrupt, were these bets coming in via the betting shop, by the telephone,
or
by the phone?
No, just telephone. No, the betting shops, I'm not sure what time it was legalised that you could stay open after 6:30, but this was purely in the call centre, telephone bets, pre-internet. Internet, in terms of betting sites, was still to come. This was prior to that. It was all telephone bets. It was debit cards. It was a couple of, we had credit accounts, but it was mainly debit cards. So we've got prices that, in the event of a goal, this is what I would be. Now, you could get that from your pre-match handicap prices. Now, depending if and when, if a goal went in, what time it went in, you would just adjust it. It would just sort of seem the right price. You have to be very careful. Teams like Man United, your top teams, if they went a goal down, you must not overcook, you must not offer too much on them. You know, if you start offering 5-2, 3-1, 7-2 to win the game with, let's say, 35 minutes left, the amount of times they've come back and won it from there. And you're governed by your field book to a certain degree. You're putting prices in. If you look back now at the prices I was putting in then, you might think, oh, Christ, that was wrong. But that was it. There was no one else doing it. Your punters would tell you if you're wrong. We would lay it to whatever suited. We would never refuse a bet. If somebody wanted 400 on, it's fine. If somebody wanted, we had big punters. We used to take bets. That's what we were there for.
Were there any people that you suddenly realised were having you that over?
I wouldn't say having us over.
Well, I mean, you know, but we're better judges than you.
Yeah, absolutely. There was, you'd hear too many people saying, oh, I'm an expert on this, I'm an expert on that. Now, okay, I was pricing up all sorts of different events. It was like a production line. I'd have an A4 book and I'd write these prices out, photocopy it for the team that built the prices in the computer system, give a copy to Teletext, a copy to the guys that put it on the screens. And it was a kind of a production line. When people started coming through betting, especially later, as the whole business grew, it was clear that on certain things, this guy knows a damn sight more about rugby league than I do, or that you might have to put a little tag on their account, later lose 500 quid, later lose 200. Yeah, which in this day and age, do you think
it's a fair bet?
I've bumped into many a person. Oh, I used to have an account with Stan James. We're talking pro punters now. I used to have an account with Stan James. I could have what I wanted. Oh, great. We would lay bets and then we'd change the prices, which to me is the way of doing it.
Yeah, now we talked about shrewdies there, yeah. People that did their homework, but there was also a few bits of skullduggery that weren't quite fair.
Well, we had accounts open, we had some trade accounts because we were supplying shops. You would always attract, as a new company, you'd always attract some the sharper people. And we had one particular customer that, if ever they came through, you'd say, well, hey, what's going on here? There's something going on. There's always something going on, but more often than not, you don't know what's going on. It was about 9:30 on a Saturday morning, the first day of the World Snooker Championship at the Crucible. Jimmy White, trying his hardest to win the World Championship, playing Peter Francisco. And Steve Fisher took the phone call. He said, I'm just going to put you on hold. Now, he's turned to me. It's his company. He's turned to me. So-and-so wants £200 on Jimmy White to win 10-2 at 6-1. Oh, no. My foot that sum it up with this. I thought, how are we going to get out of this one? Didn't want to bet. We could have just said, no, we didn't want it. But I said, just put them on hold. Say you've got to speak to a trader. They didn't know who they were speaking to.
Was that you that coined that blooming phrase as well?
What's that? Yeah, it was. Well, hang on. I'm not going to sit here and get blamed for everything. Crikey. No, so I've said to him, just say, I'm ever so sorry. I need to speak to a trader. And they didn't realise they were talking to the, you know, he's the managing director. It's his bloody firm, right? So I've gone straight on the script. I've took the price. I've suspended the betting on it on the just on that attempted bet. Put on their sent over price betting suspended frame betting Jimmy White send. Steve Fisher gone apologised, but I've ever sorry, but the frame betting's all disappeared. We can't offer you anything. Oh, not a problem. Thanks very much. They're going to try and get on somewhere else. Oh, I said, this is dodgy. Then the minute the message went out on the screens, frame betting suspended on Jimmy White, Peter Francisco, I'd get phone calls. Oh, mate, it's so-and-so in wherever they are. Yeah, Hills have cut it. They were 9-1. I think that when I checked it, I actually Googled it a couple of days ago. Hills were initially 9-1, and it had been backed all the way down to 7-4. Before they eventually suspended. Now that in
they
itself...
They gave them a lot of rope, didn't
well,
they?
Well, to be honest, that if you haven't sort of caught on by then. So anyway, at the time, and one of the group of shops was Don Bruce Racing, based in Ruislip, a dozen shops. Don Bruce was the chairman of Bowler. And a certain Steve Fisher was the vice chairman. So there were a few phone calls. Anyway, they contacted the WPBSA, Snooker Authority, and it was started on the Saturday, finished to a conclusion on the Sunday. It was the first to 10, 19 frames. They've got Jimmy White in after the first session or the Saturday, so finished 7-2. So Peter Francisco, he's done his job, he's got his two frames, job done. They've got Jimmy White in and said, Jimmy, there's some very unusual betting patterns on this snooker match. Nothing to do with me. Well, it wouldn't be. He's trying his hardest to win the World Championship. They've said to him, would you give him every opportunity to win another frame? Okay. Well, if you saw the footage for that Sunday afternoon, now all the commentary team, they're in on it. They know what's going on. Jimmy is setting him up. A simple blue to the middle pocket that Simon, I don't even know if you play snooker or pool or anything, you'd get it. I would get it 100 times, 99 times out of 100, you would pot it. Well, whispering Ted Lowe, the commentator, well, Peter needs this, he can win this frame, can he start a comeback? He's got to tap him brown to the bloody or blue to the middle pocket. He's had to miss it, hasn't he? He's hit the side cushion. Well, the extraordinary scenes, I can't remember. Such a frame. Of course, all the commentators are all in on it. And he's basically set him up for two, three frames on the trot. Of course, he cannot win this frame. A big inquiry. He got a 5-year ban, Peter Francisco. I'll just read exactly what it says. Not consistent behaviour in accordance to a professional sportsman. He got a 5-year ban for that, but he didn't actually get done for match fixing.
Did they all get paid out, the punters?
I don't think they did, no.
Okay, so after all this illustrious career with Stan James, in 2009, they've relocated to Gibraltar. You've ended up with a
trade the prices, Bob. Yeah. 75 of us made redundant. Very sad scenes, to be honest.
I can imagine. So then you've decided to work on the railways at Didcot.
2000. I had a couple of years of fiddling around with Hove and trying to flog that, which didn't take off, simple as that. Got offered a job on the railways. Well, I didn't get offered a job. I got told that there was a job going. I applied for it, got the job. I was dispatching trains at Didcot Parkway, 10 miles from me. Always been interested in trains and railways, and I thought, do you know what? I'm probably going to have to get a job at some point. This will do for me. And I worked there for 11 years.
You didn't think, surely a man with your experience, you could have gone into the betting industry? Had it changed that much?
I had offers. I pretty much had offers. But to be honest, there wasn't anything going to happen in the industry that I hadn't already seen or even kind of brought in, instigated it. Nothing was going to happen in that industry to excite me anymore.
And Betfair is fully entrenched at this point.
It was, yeah.
I mean, the people I've spoken to, and I think it's fairly obvious to say that if you can accurately price anything, it's a shoo-in that you'll win punting. If you've got the knack to price up anything accurately. So did you Betfair at its height, loads of liquidity? Were you not tempted to become a professional punter or at least a professional trader?
While I was working on the railway, I hadn't been to Swindon. When I eventually went back there, I think there was a gap of about 15 years. I would wake up, I'd go and do my work in there. I would wake up and not even be thinking about having a bet. It's never really bothered me having a bet. I was just kind of not overly bothered. Till I retired with a master plan of this is how I'm going to make my money. I would back horses. I would use Betfair. I'd back horses with bookmakers. I would only have a bet with a bookmaker if there was an opportunity there. I would back with the bookmakers. I would lay it slightly shorter
on
the exchange.
Hang on a minute, that's Arbin.
Well, it kind of is. It is Arbin, but however...
I don't see anything wrong with Arbin, I hasten to add that. Anyway.
Sorry?
I don't see anything wrong with Arbin, I hasten to add that.
Well, this is how I see it. If you as a bookmaker put up 11-4, and I want 60 quid on it, and I should be on, right? If it's still there 5 minutes later, and I want another 60 quid, surely, if you don't want to lay it, you should have cut it to 5-2. That's the basics of it. And I think I would be fair in saying that. Well, I would only have a bet if I could take advantage of an opportunity. But the real key thing was if and when the horse would win at a bigger price, excuse me, than I backed it at. So in other words, if I've had 60 quid at 3-1 and it wins at 4s, there's 60 quid extra for me. And that was like my, that was taken, I mean, there was a few quid spinning around different accounts and on the exchange, but that was like my bonus, if you can understand that. And in the short time that it lasted, it's only lasted 4 months, I was getting over a grand a month in best odds guaranteed payouts, plus the odds, you know, 40 quid a day, 50 quid a day. I'd bet 15, 20 horses a day, 70 quid a day. I could do it 7 days a week, with a minimum of fuss, two phones, laptop, sit indoors, go out, park up in the car somewhere, pick and choose, do it on the train. It's all there. I'm getting information. I'm 0% commission on the exchange. The only downside, can't get a bet on. That was the end of that.
So, finally and briefly, are you retired now from it?
I would say, from betting, honestly, even though
you do all those prices, you put that work in?
Yeah, I would say yes. I would say yes. I do. I enjoy pricing the dogs up. I enjoy going over more for a social catch-up with a couple of trainers and owners, but it's more a social side. I don't need to look to go betting. I'm retired is the word.
But if anybody wants the benefit of your wisdom, they can message you on
Twitter.
Message
me, yeah, more than willing to help. Brilliant. More than willing.
Well, Steve Cooling, thank you very much.
No problem, Simon.